So tonight we're talking about the seven factors of awakening. And to just give some context as to where that's found, the seven factors are found in the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness. And they're part of the various lists that are in the fourth foundation, the foundation of dhammas, or various categories of experience. And in that section, you find also the teachings on the hindrances that Anna and Steve talked about last month, the five aggregates of clinging, which is about non-self, the four noble truths, the dependent origination, which we have been studying all year, and the seven factors. So there's a lot of meaty subjects in that Satipatthana Sutta and the fourth foundation. And the Buddha talks about the seven factors. He said, abandon the five hindrances, firmly establish the four foundations, and realize the seven factors of awakening. The Buddha called these the anti-hindrances. The seven factors are good news. You know, the Buddha is known to have said that he teaches two things, suffering and the end of suffering. Well, the seven factors are about the end of suffering. And before Susan and I go over each of these seven factors, I'd like to take a minute and just reflect on the word awakening. Sometimes the list is called the seven factors of enlightenment. And when I first heard it, I thought, wow, that's really grandiose. And so I like the word awakening. It feels like an active process verb, and that I can have moments of being awake. It feels close and attainable and real. It's a process of waking up from delusions, waking up from ignorance, from being lost in old beliefs and opinions, waking up from wanting to change the moment to make it something better. So as we talk about the seven factors and explore this, and you'll have a chance perhaps in your small groups, you'll want to talk about this. What are your own thoughts about awakening, both in general and for you personally? For me, I believe in the possibility of awakening because I've had some small moments of it, moments where I actually felt the freedom of not being tied to at least one old way of thinking. And I think of awakening, to use Joseph Goldstein's phrase, of small moments many times. And these small moments of presence, of insight, of being untethered to the need to fix or change things. In the suttas, awakening is often described as this moment of a lightning bolt of awareness and enlightenment. Perhaps that's an image that helps for you. Perhaps you have another one. But whatever your view of awakening, this list is about how to get there. They are the antidote to the hindrances, and the hindrances that create a veil or a block to clear seeing. They obstruct the practice of attention, and they take us off the present moment through craving or pushing away dullness, agitation, or doubt. And the seven factors address the process where the obstructions are not present and there's an openness to clarity. We're encouraged to starve the hindrances and feed the seven factors. Some of the teachers describe these seven factors as really good friends. In fact, Guy Armstrong says that along with the Brahma Viharas, the seven factors are your best friends. And I think of the seven factors as good news. Now, good news, again, we might want to put that into context, because good news doesn't mean that all of a sudden the reality of life being imperfect, impermanent, and impersonal is going to end, that somehow life in all its difficulties is going to stop being difficult. And in fact, when you really, grok the truth of what the Buddha has taught, to some extent, life gets a little more difficult. As many of you here have been practicing for a lot of years, and we can testify to how once you really start being encouraged to look at the lunacy that we've been practicing of striving for happiness through things that are never going to give that to us, that don't last. That once you start doing that, it can feel pretty difficult. So it's not that the life is all of a sudden going to become easy, but it's about the reality that there is a process for dealing with those difficulties where we can experience those moments of freedom, those moments of awakening. Anallio, who is one of the teachers in our tradition, says something that's very encouraging. He says that the very presence of the factors in our own minds testifies to our capacity to awaken. However weak they might be, they can become stronger. That's so encouraging, that the very presence of mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity, even for a moment, testifies to our capacity to awaken. And the Buddha is known to have said that if he didn't believe that we could do this process of freedom, he wouldn't ask it of us. So the seven factors, they're sequential, and they actually build on each other, but they also support each other and strengthen each other. There are three sections. Mindfulness has its own section. And then the other two are arousing factors of investigation, energy, and joy, which I'm going to talk about, and the calming factors of tranquility, concentration, and equanimity, which Susan will be talking about. And for each of these seven, Susan and I have come up with two words that on our resource page, where we suggest books and talks for you to follow up, we've listed the seven factors plus the overall seven factors, which I call good news. And we put two words for each of them, which might be helpful as you continue to practice. So mindfulness is the first, and the two words are here and now. It's part of our very nature to have the capacity to be mindful, to be aware of what's happening right now. We don't have to find this capacity. We just need to utilize it. You know, it's the teachers, we've heard this so many times where the teachers will say that the problem isn't being aware, it's the problem is remembering to be aware. We already have so much experience with mindfulness, you know, watching TV or a movie, being engaged in a really good conversation, learning a sport or learning a musical instrument, singing a song, reading a good book. We know what mindfulness is really about. We know how to do this. And nearly every teaching of the Buddha and all of the different lists that we've been covering in this 9-month series includes some commentary on mindfulness, non-judgmental present moment awareness of what's happening in this moment and the next moment and the next. Not trying to change or fix anything, just being with what is happening, seeing it, feeling it, knowing it, leaving it alone, and growing to understand what is happening as we observe all of this. Mindfulness is the key to all the other factors. It provides the balancing between the arousing energy and the calming energy, and it acts as a bridge between them. So after we go to from here and now to investigation, the two words are be curious. Investigation is a function of wisdom. We bring interest to what is happening in the moment, and we do that in order to see clearly and to gain some understanding. Part of this be curious is asking a lot of questions. Are we stuck? What does stuck feel like? Where are we stuck? What kinds of habits are up right now that I'm so stuck to? Where are the hindrances? Which one is present? What's happening right now? Is this thought or this collection of thoughts or this story about me, is it true? Again, we ask these questions over and over again in order to understand what's really going on. You know, throughout the teachings, the Buddha uses a lot of images. One of them is, and this must not have come from the Buddha because I don't think they had magnifying glasses 2,600 years ago. But the teachers use, current teachers talk about using a magnifying glass so that you can really dig in and see all the details. For me, the image that's really helpful is enhancing my peripheral vision so that I can see outside of what I usually look at, what I usually call reality. Instead of only seeing within these predetermined, strongly held notions of who I am, what's really going on, what this all means, I open up my field of vision. So investigation both deepens through the magnifying glass and broadens through peripheral vision our seeing. And we see that the old notions, the habits, just like we've been talking about in the whole year of dependent origination, all of those habits of thought. And then this curiosity really feeds and fuels the next factor, which is energy. I want to share something from my own practice. You know, we all come from our own families of origin with our own kind of version of childhood. And often young people make decisions, emotional and mental decisions of how to make sense of the world that they're in. And given my particular family of origin and the circumstances, I made a decision to be Susie Sunshine. And so I saw only the happy things. I was always bringing everything back to what's good and what's happy, and let's see the plus side of things. And while this childhood decision that I've continued throughout my adult life has had its merit, it has some serious drawbacks, especially in the practice where the very first noble truth is to know that there is unsatisfactoriness and really experience it. Really let it in, really fully understand it. You know, through the practicing with the hindrances, I've come to see and feel the depth of my resistance to pushing away those afflictive emotions, the negative or troublesome stuff in life. I can't honestly say that I'm starving the resistance, but I'm certainly more aware that I'm not feeding it like I used to. I've been focused a lot on feeding the investigation into this long-held view, this habit of mind. And the investigation has led me to making a really strong intention to step out of that and to explore way more fully what is actually happening in the moment, both the positive and the negative. That kind of investigation really has given me a lot of energy for my practice. And of course, there in this investigation, there's some tension between the intention to fully explore and the resistance that I'm so used to. But I have to say, kind of proudly of myself, that I'm navigating that tension. And I think that's what investigation kind of leads us to. So the third factor is energy. And the two words I have for that is just right. Kind of like the Goldilocks approach to energy. It's energy for the practice. Just the right amount of energy, not the overstriving, efforting to try to fix things. And this energy is what really makes continuity of practice possible. You know, we hear a lot about continuity of practice, and I love the way one of the teachers, Guy Armstrong, describes it. He said, mindfulness is not perpetually continuous because we're not arhats or Buddhas, at least not yet. Maybe there are some in our group, but it's about mindfulness being frequent. We bring as much energy, as much effort as possible, as frequently as possible. So this energy yields and strengthens the persistence to come back to the cushion, it yields and strengthens a full commitment to the practice. When we first sat down, I asked you to just think about, you know, why do you come to your to the cushion over and over again? Why do you come to our Monday nights and Sunday mornings and the Buddhist essentials? You, this commitment to our practice and the energy that is that grows from the mindfulness and the investigation keeps fueling that commitment to practice. The fourth factor is joy. And I couldn't come up with two words, so I got four. Delight in the practice. This is joy in the practice. You know, sometimes when I tell people that I've been practicing a form of Buddhism for many years, they go, oh, it's such a downer, you know, suffering and all that. But I find an amazing amount of joy in the practice. And actually in the teachings, there are lots of teachings about joy. Kamala Masters, and I think we've included one of her talks on the seven factors. She's the one who I learned this idea that joy is the delight in practice. And Gil Fronsdale defines joy as joy because we're engaged. Joyful interest that arises from full engagement, from the full investigation, from bringing our best energy. We really take delight in these moments when we're really present, when we see what is actually happening, when we're aware of old beliefs that might be preventing us from full engagement. One more example from my own life and practice. So again, my childhood circumstances, my mother was widowed very young with three children, and the oldest of whom was born disabled. So in my little family of four, two people took up all the available space. And as a little person, I made the decision that my needs weren't very important because other people's needs were way more important. And so throughout my young adult years and into my 40s and beyond, I often understood situations through that filter. And I remember the day, I don't remember the exact circumstances, but I was involved with some other people. There was a little bit of a rub, not a big conflict, but then we were kind of, you know, there was some tension in the room. And the thought came in of, oh, right, you know, well, my needs aren't important. What should I do here? And then there was this voice, and I call it the Dharma voice that I experienced. The Dharma voice said to me, Suze, that's not what's going on here. And it wasn't exactly like a lightning bolt. It was more like kind of a big wave washing over me, saying that, do you really mean that I could look at this moment and this event differently? I could experience it differently. I could investigate what's really going on. I could, you know, not totally set aside that childhood filter and decision, because I'm not sure we ever totally set it aside, but at least it was just kind of in my pocket as opposed to, you know, at the driving the car. And that's the kind of joy I'm talking about, where we're honest, we're mindful, we're honest, we're investigating, we're asking all these questions, not with judgments. When things come up, we don't go, oh, you dumb, whatever, there you go again. It's not that kind of investigation. It's really exploring so that understanding and wisdom can happen. And we're mindful as frequently as possible. Remember, for those of you who sat with Philip Moffat last weekend or the weekend before, he kept on saying, to the best that you were able. I think he must have said that 50 or 100 times during the weekend, and I love it, because that's the same thing with this practice. To the best that we're able, as frequently as possible, bringing that presence of mindfulness. What's going on? Then that curious, inquisitive attitude. What's happening here? You know, be willing to look at those old beliefs and filters and the habits that you go through. And you might decide in the end, oh, that's a good habit. I think I'll keep it. But at least you're opening up the possibility that maybe it's time to let it go and look at things more as they really are. And then that curiosity, that inquisitive attitude and no judgment really feeds energy, the energy in the practice. This is good stuff. That's what the kind of energy. It's like, wow, this is good stuff. And out of that comes a delight, a joy in the practice, a joy of discovery.